Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm also good. Doing great. Been a busy week, but here we are in the middle of it, and as always, we do it here on Wednesday nights. And in some ways, I kind of look at Fast Forward Radio is, I don't know, it's like it's the very middle of the week here at the evening, and it's all downhill from here. The rest of the week, it just seems to fly by. So
it's just practically the weekend after this.
Yeah. That's
almost
right.
Think
it's
of this
just,
show as kind of the beginning
right
of the week.
We're just cruising right to the weekend now. So
we are cruising to the weekend. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's what we're here to do. We're here to, we're here to get you set for the future. And what lies in your immediate future, folks? The weekend does. That's right. So we're about the far future and the near future. You know, it's all good.
Well, whatever works. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that's a good point. Yeah, it's been a busy couple of weeks for me. I'd had a quick turnaround trip to Boston last week, left on Thursday night, arrived at Boston at midnight, came back Friday, and arrived back in Denver at midnight, and then proceeded to get a flat tire on my way home from the airport. So,
that's a bummer.
That's like, this is already kind of pushing it anyway. You know, when you arrive at midnight both times, you think, I'm losing some sleep in this deal, right? And so you're driving home, and it's 2 in the morning. I'm on this, like, remote highway between my house and the airport, and I hear this, and I'm like, oh, that's not a good sound.
I didn't need that.
Yeah.
Well,
veering off.
So here's the question. At 2 in the morning, did you do the manly thing, get out and change it yourself, even though you're exhausted, or call AAA, or how'd you handle that one?
I totally called AAA. Let me give you my reasons why I'm still a man, even though I called AAA. Okay. First off, what am I paying for? Right. I pay for AAA. What exactly am I paying for? Okay. Secondly, their jack is so much better than this piece of crap that they put in the car. Right. It's so much faster for those guys than it is for me. Third, and I think most importantly, the speed limit's like 75 miles an hour. It's pitch dark outside. And I don't want to be standing there right next to traffic potentially doing that. You know, I've reached a point in my life where I kind of gauge the unsafeness of that. And I'm like, because when the car shows up, actually, it turned out it wasn't AAA that came. AAA dispatcher called. This is an interesting thing. We've got this toll road to the airport called E-47, and they have a courtesy service where they actually send a truck out that will give people a jump start or change a flat for them for free. So they sent those guys out. But, that guy shows up, and he's got the flashing lights, and he's got the big spotlights, and, it's like the whole thing becomes markedly, I think, safer at that point than it is with just me out there, because I didn't have any flares or anything. And I totally wimped out, and those are my reasons.
Well, those are three great reasons. I would just add, you're doing your part in a poor economy to make sure that people have jobs. Person who took
that's
the call,
right.
The person who eventually came out to help. If it weren't for kind-hearted people like you, they would they would be without a job. So
all these people changing their own flats are not helping the economy.
That's right.
They're a little bit selfish, is what you're saying.
Just a little bit. Yeah.
They're just they're not thinking about the other guy like I always do. That's funny because that rationale never even occurred to me, but I like it. I like adding that one to the list. Okay. Oh, enough of the story of Phil's adventures changing flight. Well, okay, but while we're there, what would you have done, Stephen? Would you have gotten out the kit and done it yourself?
Well, you know, I have on many occasions, but I got to tell you, at 2
well,
in the
I
morning.
Have don't get the impression I haven't done that when it's been required.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. But at 2 in the morning on a busy interstate, you better believe I'd be on that phone and have somebody out there. So exactly. Let me just ask, it's 2 in the morning. You had had this huge long day with all this traveling and everything. So were you on modafinil? That's my next question.
Ah, see, that's the question. No. Now, had I been, because here's the thing, you know. You know when you're kind of, I mean, it's not like I was incapacitated and shouldn't have been driving. But
right.
Probably not as sharp as I could have been or should have been. Because even driving out of the airport, I was thinking, wow, this thing's out of alignment or something. I mean, it never occurred to me that I had a tire going flat, right? That scenario didn't pop into my head. Right, I was thinking, this guy's kind of pulling off. I'm going to have to get that alignment check next time I take it in for service. And then didn't think any, you know, then just kind of adjusted for that as I drove. And a few minutes later, you know, I blow out a tire.
Right.
So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Not only was I not as perceptive as I could have been and not making as good of decisions as I could have been making, but probably if that blowout had been a little more – you know, those things don't always go where you get to just pull over to the side of the road and everything's okay. You know, there's like deep ravines and stuff there on the E-470, and I could have ended up in a really bad mess. You know, reaction time and all that kind of stuff wouldn't have been as good as it would have been, you know, on a typical day at 10 a.m. Right? If I'd been out, had my coffee and all that kind of stuff. So enter the era of the smart drugs. Maybe I should start thinking about in the future when I've got a late night drive home from the airport or late night drive anywhere, early morning drive anywhere, to be on these smart drugs. These are this is our drug of topic tonight. So let's get into this. Tell us about modafinil.
Okay, modafinil. Yeah, well, we have. We've mentioned this particular drug on Fast Forward Radio, I think, you know, probably 3 or 4 years ago. It's
yeah,
sort of been on our radar for a while. And what makes it interesting is that it appears not to be habit-forming. It's not a drug I've ever tried. Phil, have you ever had occasion to take modafinil? I guess, you know, you can tell me in my own business if you want to, but I've never personally.
I've never had it. No, I've never had it.
All right. It's approved apparently by the FDA as a treatment only for narcolepsy, but it is widely used by other people. You know, a little bit like Viagra is used by lots of men who don't have erectile dysfunction. So, modafinil takes away the need for sleep. And apparently people can take it over a long period of time and sleep very little and with few to no side effects. And that's pretty remarkable. But more than that, I mean, even
wait, I'm sorry, what was the Viagra connection there? You lost me just for a second on the Viagra thing.
Okay, well, lots of men who apparently do not have ED, erectile dysfunction, have used Viagra and other things like that to enhance their sex life. So even if they don't have what doctors
Oh, I see what you're saying. Even though they don't have erectile dysfunction, they use it as like an extra boost. So you're saying
there you go.
Now I'm
following
you.
They got a little turbo.
People who don't have narcolepsy are taking modafinil because it gives them.
You see, that's the connection. Anyway, lots of people that don't have narcolepsy are using modafinil, and apparently it goes beyond taking away, just allowing a person to operate. For many, many hours without the need for sleep. It goes beyond that. Even if, let's say, I've rested up normally, I take the drug now in an hour or so, I'm sharper and more alert than someone who is than I would have been without the drug, and that effect is immediate, and it's demonstrable too. They test people. So the question that was raised by Glenn Reynolds this week is, you know, should doctors, and I guess any other professionals that, you know, depend on being sharp mentally, is it malpractice for these people not to be taking this medicine? And so, you know, I mean, I guess that's a pretty interesting question, isn't it?
Well, that is. And it's in light of a research study that Glenn linked specifically around doctors, showing that that this drug makes them better able to make decisions, showing better reaction time, just generally being I mean, it's not like they were giving doctors modafinil and then sending them, you know, one group in to do open heart surgery with modafinil and a control group without a, you know, to test. But they were subjecting them to tests that give you some indication of response time and accuracy of response and just general alertness and decision making. And the doctors taking modafinil are just way ahead of the game. So there's this interesting question. Before we get to the question of malpractice, maybe we want to say, all things being equal, you know, if your doctor has just pulled a 16-hour shift and he's just now getting to you, right?
Right.
In light of that research, would you rather he had a shot of that stuff or not, right? I mean, that's the question.
I can tell you what I would say.
Yeah?
Number one, you know, if the guy's operating on me, I for sure would want him to be either fresh or at least medicated. You know, I sure don't want him nodding off in the middle of my surgery. So, exactly.
You want him as close to fresh as you can get, right? Yeah. Or
exactly.
You want that doctor to be as good as he's going to be. You want the maximum performance out of that individual. So certainly there is a potential patient benefit and even a patient demand. Clearly there's a benefit for the doctors because they want to do well. They want to perform well. It's not just a matter of avoiding liability, although their lives probably seem to revolve increasingly around that. But I mean, most doctors, they want to do a good job, right? They want to make the right decisions, and they want to administer good care. And you would think that over time, as results like these became more commonplace, that you'd see more and more doctors saying, you know, this is something that doesn't just enhance my ability to perform my job. This is something that I feel is a requirement in order to do my job as well as I can do it. And I can definitely see it becoming widely adopted. The question is, I think, could it ever become standardized, right? Because in order for Glenn's scenario to pan out, that's what would have to happen. You would have to say that the reasonable standard of care includes taking modafinil.
Yeah, that's really the definition of malpractice, is a breach of the standard of care for that profession in that particular community. So there's a certain way that doctors operate, and I don't mean that as like an operation, but standard operating procedures, okay, to do anything. If there's a certain way that is, you know, that doctors operate in that community, and you do something less than that, and you breach that standard, that is considered malpractice. So, basically, you know, this is kind of the boring way to get to the answer of this, but in order for it to ever become malpractice, you pretty much would have to have, you know, it to be the normal standard for doctors in that community to all be operating, you know, going to work every day on modafinil or some other performance enhancing type drug. So
it would have to have become as standard for a doctor to be on modafinil as it is for them to scrub right before performing surgery. I mean, we're talking about it would have to be that level of standardization. And it's hard to imagine us getting to that point. But
well, I don't know that we get to that point with modafinil. Modafinil is
yeah.
interesting. I think that what you might get to that point, though, Phil, when you get to maybe the next generation of smart drugs.
Right.
You know, if they come out with a smart drug in a few years that gives us all 50 IQ points, you know, and it's
right.
And there's no real downside to it. There's no, we just operate just at that much better on that drug. Then, you know, pretty much then, if your job has anything to do with intellect at all, I think it could quickly become a breach of the standard of care not to take something and not to take that medicine when you're on the job. It's, you know, it'd be a little bit like going to work intoxicated. As a doctor, you know,
although the difference, right, is that it's a difference between actively engaging in bad behavior that has incapacitated
right.
you versus taking an additional step that would more fully capacitate you.
exactly.
But yeah, I mean, you can hear the court case coming eventually, right? I mean, Will
yeah.
in the chat room says standard practice may be not required, but that's the problem. Once it becomes standard practice, it is required for doctors, right? And
yeah.
it's possible that some of these things aren't – it's not codified that it's standard practice. It's just understood that it is, and it might ultimately be a civil court ruling that establishes it as standard practice. Somebody might sue and say, if this doctor had taken the pill that boosts your IQ 50 points, he would not have made this bad surgical error and my husband would have lived, and, you know, she gets awarded $50 million. And then that precedent, suddenly it is a requirement, not because
right.
it's a legal requirement, but simply because no doctor who refuses to take that drug would ever be able to get malpractice insurance anymore. Right. I mean, that would be the,
Exactly.
I mean, that's kind of the driver. That's probably what establishes standard practice as much as anything else. There's certain things you have to do in order to keep your malpractice premiums within an affordable range. It'd be interesting. We should actually have a doctor on to talk about this at some point. It gets very technical and into the legal angle, but a lot of that is what we do have half the battle. At least we got a lawyer on here, right, Stephen? So you deal with these issues in your day job.
Sometimes. Terry Grossman would be a great doctor to ask this question of, and just see what he thinks about that, because he's plugged into these issues and he's also a MD, so perhaps we can have him on the show and ask. Yeah.
Yeah. Next, maybe we'll have him on and talk. It'd be a good show, actually, just to do kind of a future of medicine, not from the – we often talk about wonder drugs and wonder treatments and nanomedicine and all that kind of stuff, but just kind of the future of the medical practice, right? The future of the medical profession gets stickier and stickier in a lot of different ways when we start thinking about a lot of these scenarios. And, performance enhancement is a big one, and that's our topic here this evening, but you can also look at things like artificial intelligence coming online, nanomedicine coming online, all kinds of interesting issues that'll be coming up for
How about this one, Phil? You know, you mean you operated on this person, doctor, without consulting with Watson first? You know,
exactly.
I could see that coming up. Watson, referring, of course, to the AI that beat the champions on Jeopardy. You know, if Watson is given the equivalent of a med school education and he's proven to be smarter than on things like this than the typical doctor, does it become malpractice not to consult before taking some big step like a surgery? At some point, maybe it could. I think that's certainly a foreseeable future.
It is, and not only medicine, medicinal forms of enhancement, but also like neural implants accessing AIs, all kinds of options that if they were widely enough adopted to be accepted as something that you can expect a doctor to do. You know, would those be grounds for malpractice if a doctor didn't do it? Well, I can tell you that I wrote about this over on Transparency Revolution, and Will Brown, who's in the chat room this evening and who was my guest on the Transparency Revolution podcast today, was good enough to leave a comment here. And I'm just going to read a little bit from this because I think this is this goes to how quick will doctors actually be to adopt this. This is something I hadn't thought about. He writes, "The enhanced docs would be making more and possibly more diversified enhanced range of specialty or general practice decisions per a given period of time, thereby increasing the statistical odds of their being responsible for a misdiagnosis or some other mistake, overlooked test, record-keeping error, etc. I think there's an equally good argument for enhanced doctors needing insurance relief relative to their unenhanced colleagues due to the increase in malpractice insurance premiums they must pay as a result of their unique market capability." So, you know, there's this thought that if I'm enhanced and I'm suddenly capable of doing much more, I'm just taking that much more risk, right? Which I didn't think about it from that standpoint when I first wrote about this, and as we were talking about this earlier. But as I read over this, that is a possibility. That might be one of the reasons that that doctors would be slow to take this up. They have to be, I think, more than ordinarily risk averse when it comes to issues of culpability, not culpability, what's the word, liability in the care that they give, right? Because they're thinking about it all the time. So we look at it and go, well, doctors, they want to do a better job, so they'll take this so they can be faster and do a better job. But a doctor might look at this and go, oh, no, I'm going to be treating more patients. That's dangerous, right? Which I wouldn't have immediately thought of. What's your take on that, Stephen?
Well, you know, I think that doctors are like anybody else. They want to do they generally want to do as good of a job as they're capable of doing. I think that right now there are a lot of people that are making it through professional school, the rigors of professional school, using modafinil. You know, they, whether it be law school or med school, things like that, they're using various drugs like that. And, you know, let's say you used it during some of the more stressful times in med school when you needed to cram, then, you know, that person, don't you think, particularly if they're faced with a super long shift in their residency or they're in an extremely, you know, stressful operation that's running 5 and 6 hours, don't you think that they would be tempted to take modafinil? I think that they would, particularly if they already know how it works in their system and what advantages it gives. So I think that it's not necessarily something that the older guys that have been around and not using modafinil all these years would be much tempted to do. But I think the new guys coming up probably would. And here's an economics question for you, Phil. Let's just say that these drugs are available, and let's say a combination of these drugs and AIs that we can consult with, or maybe neural implants, and all these different things are available and are being used on a regular basis in 10 or 15 years. What is the effect, do you think, on the price of malpractice insurance? And ultimately the price of medicine, you know, of various, you know, what either health insurance or our patients pay for health care. I think it would be downward pressure on the price of these things, both malpractice insurance.
I think so too. Assuming the enhanced performance truly is enhanced, right?
Right.
We'll make the argument
right.
That maybe what you have is just lots more performance in
right.
the same period of time. And so you don't get the enhancement benefit, and therefore you've increased the risk. But assuming it's the former, assuming that you're
there are studies, by the way, that show that it is actually making you more alert, and you're doing a better job. Not just that you're awake to do more jobs, you are doing a better job with each individual job, according to these studies. So if we take
then I have to agree that it would be downward pressure on the cost of malpractice premiums. That And that, yeah, medicine, the cost of medical care generally would benefit greatly, I think, from doctors who enjoyed that level of enhancement. And of course, we could be looking at significantly higher levels of enhancement, as you said, from later generations of these kinds of drugs. We're really only in the early stages of looking at and thinking about these kinds of things. Well, you know, this was on my mind when I was over at Kurzweil AI, and I saw this piece by Amara Angelica. And I don't know if you saw this one, Stephen. Fed-funded research, magic mushrooms create, in quotes, openness. And I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs here because this is...
By the way, I'm just going to throw out this public service announcement. Kids, stay off drugs. Anyway, go ahead.
Kids, do not do drugs, okay?
Yeah.
Please. Yeah, I think we've made our position clear on the speculus, but it's always good to have a reminder of that. Okay, so
yeah.
A single high dose of the hallucinogen psilocybine, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, was enough to bring about a measurable and lasting personality change, openness, lasting at least a year in nearly 60% of the 51 participants in a new study, says researchers at Johns Hopkins. And I'll skip down a little bit. By openness, they mean traits related to imagination, aesthetics, feelings, abstract ideas, and general broad-mindedness, the researcher said. Changes in these traits measured on a widely used and scientifically validated personality inventory were larger in magnitude than changes typically observed in healthy adults over decades of life experiences, the scientists say. Now, this is fascinating, okay, because here's our real challenge, okay? We've often talked about if there was a nice pill, you know, Shouldn't some people take it? Well, here's kind of a, you know, open-minded, creative, imaginative, accepting pill, right? And it's been around for a long time. People take it. They don't take it to have that impact on them. They take it because it makes them see flying snakes and makes them, you know, laugh until they pass out. And you know, I've heard, right, other kinds of effects. But If you can show that a drug, and magic mushrooms is a, you know, it's an extreme example, obviously, but if you could show that a drug had that kind of impact on people, with the example already in place of, sure, it could reasonably be expected for a doctor to take a performance enhancement, mind enhancement drug in order to make good decisions, you know, why would it then be completely unreasonable to say maybe a teacher or someone who you know, who has to deal with, you know, a customer service rep or somebody who has to deal with other people, who needs to be very open, who needs to think imaginatively, who needs to be flexible, that they might have to take a dose of mushrooms once a year? Would we actually be heading in the direction where certain jobs you would apply for, they give you a pre-employment screening drug test to make sure you've taken the right drugs in the year leading up to that so that you fit the right personality profile? What do you think, Stephen?
I suspect that artists already are have done this. You know, I'm not suggesting that all artists have taken illegal drugs. I would suggest to you that there's probably a higher percentage of people that are artsy, who are creative, that it probably experimented with some drugs or another. And so I think that people that are attracted to that mode of creativity are probably, you know, tend to take those kind of drugs. This is just me speaking, without actually, you know, this is not me passing judgment. This is just me saying that's probably already the case.
Yeah, well, I think you might be onto something there. And the thing is, there's usually not a pre-employment screening process for becoming an artist, right? You just become
one. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you are able to express something that other people find interesting, then you're an artist, I guess. You know, maybe you're an artist even before then. You're just expressing yourself, and then eventually somebody catches on to you. But I think there's probably already some of that going on with that particular line of living anyway.
Well, I think so too. I would actually think, in fact, that that people who work in very creative, very right brain kinds of lines of work probably, this is pure speculation, but I would think that that effect is less pronounced on them because they're already seeking a lot of different channels that open up those parts of the brain, and they probably have a natural aptitude in that direction anyway. The question is, what if you want some of those traits in more left brain people, right? I've been reading a book. Actually, I'm rereading it. I read it once, and I'm on my second reading now. A book called A Whole New Mind, which talks about the need for in our present era for synthesis between left brain and right brain thinking, and talks a good deal about how we're kind of moving out of a left brain dominant age into an age that still requires all that logical, rational analysis, but really needs a lot of the creative and aesthetic side on top of it. That's kind of the missing piece that's sort of being filled in now. I cannot recall the author's name off the top of my head, but I'll include it in the show notes anyway. The book's called A Whole New Mind, and one of the things that occurs to me is that if you could take the stigma of hallucinogen mushrooms out of the equation, if you just said there is a medication that makes you more open, that broadens your aesthetic sense and makes you open to other people and makes you appreciate feelings and abstract ideas and general broad-minded principles in a better way, that might actually become might be viewed as a performance enhancement drug in its own right. You would definitely want it not to be people eating mushrooms, because I think that would be eternally stigmatized. And there is the whole problem of it's a narcotic. I mean, it's a hallucinogen. In addition to the fact of whatever benefit it provides, but I think there is a real possibility that enhancements could go in directions as odd as this. We've talked an awful lot about performance enhancements around athletes, and here we've talked about them a little bit around doctors. But I think for the general population, people are going to be looking at using these. Modafinil has applications to a lot of people besides people in the medical. I mean, a truck driver, right, could benefit tremendously from modafinil. I would think.
Yeah.
Anybody who works a graveyard shift could. And enhancement in some of these other areas, actually opening up your mind to being able to do kinds of modes of thinking that you've not been particularly good at or particularly comfortable with, that's a really intriguing idea, especially if they were to isolate something that went the other way. Because, there's a lot of people who are great at seeing the big picture and think aesthetically and think in very broad principles, but don't do the rational analysis piece very well. If you could give a pill to somebody and make them like understand math, right?
How about this? what if there's medicine, a pill of some sort, that would allow someone who's very liberal that spend a few hours seeing the world as a conservative? Or vice versa, what if we could spike Rush Limbaugh's coffee right before he goes on the show, and he turns into an Air America host for 3 hours. That would be pretty funny. And then the other way around too, Barney Frank before he's on the floor of the Congress. It'd be hilarious.
Just give him a big dose of right wing right before then.
Yeah, that's right. it would just be hilarity ensues, right? Well, I wonder if people, if drugs were available like that, if people would experiment with it just to see the world as the other half of the country does, just for a little while. And I wonder if that would have any long-term impact on somebody. After you've seen the world the way the other half sees it, does that change the way you operate going forward, or what? I don't know. What do you think?
I think that's a great idea. You're getting right to the heart of it, because ultimately what we're talking about here, the intriguing thing to me about this story about the mushrooms is that we really are talking about something kind of profound happening inside the brain. We know that our brain wiring is something that we do and something that is done to us in a combination that we don't understand very well, and we aren't able to control as well as we would like. We tend to believe that we are perfectly rational products of having synthesized all the information that's been available to us and made the right moral decisions and come to the positions that we have in the world based on that. But the truth is, you know, we've got a bunch of synapses that send us in one direction because they got formed that way, either because we had a proclivity in that direction or because we did make a few rational choices or just a lot of random combinations of those two things. So, yeah, if you could go in and rewire some of that circuitry, it's interesting to think if it could be done temporarily. I mean, based on the mushrooms thing, it sounds like it might be more of a long-term kind of effect. But I think people would be interested in that because people are ultimately, I think, empathetic towards their fellow human beings. There's an awful lot of hostility in political dialogue these days, but I think that ultimately we want to understand each other. And we want not to think of each other as being evil, especially, you know, as we've talked about in a lot of other issues, it's a lot easier to condemn random liberals or random conservatives, you know, random Occupy Wall Street crowd or random Tea Party people than it is like somebody you know, right? If somebody you know is in that movement, then who's close to you, then suddenly you're wanting to look a little closer into it and have a better understanding. So yeah, I think people would try it. There's this possibility that yeah, we might enjoy some better living through pharmacology here, that we could in some ways come to understand our own thinking better ultimately and maybe come to understand each other a little bit better in the process. That sounds very idealistic, but I think it is possible.
Or how about this? You give Penn Jillette or some other famous atheist a pill to give him a religious experience. You know, who knows? You know, these things are possible. You know,
that's an interesting one. Although I think I don't have any of the details. Nothing's coming to the top of my head, but it seems there is some place where they do something in a sensory deprivation tank or something that gives people religious experiences. And I think atheists
It is some sort of MRI. It's like an
MRI. That's right. Okay. Yeah.
And they
stimulate just the right part of the brain and people have a religious experience, right?
Exactly. And so I forget what effect would it does it have on atheists that have had that thing put on them?
I don't know. We should look into that.
I need to look that one up. That's interesting. I want to hear about that. So,
yeah. Because that would give you a hint. I mean, that's a much harder thing about MRI. That's a big problem, you know, to have to go to that. If you could just get a prescription, say to your doctor, I'm feeling like life is meaningless. I want to believe in God. Give me the God pill.
I need the God pill. Yeah, that's.
I'm going to try that for 30 days, and I would think that there could be some really profound consequences to this. I mean, some really dangerous ones too, because when we start seeing everything that we hold to be most true and most important as something that we can edit, that's kind of a scary thought. We've talked about with PJ. If people decide that all this empathy and concern for their fellow human beings is something that's holding them back, and if they could just cut that part of themselves out, they'd get ahead a lot better in this world. They'd get a lot farther in this world. I mean, that's not a direction that we necessarily want to see people going, but it is implied by the same kind of idea. Although certainly I can't think of any reason that any ethical medical practitioner would ever prescribe a treatment of removing empathy or removing like decent compassionate behavior from a human being. And it's kind of hard to imagine somebody feeling that way. It seems like you'd already have to be kind of psycho to get that idea, wouldn't you?
Well, you know, what if you were taking some men into battle? You know.
Okay, there you go. Exactly.
I could see them. I could see them running some sort of drug trial like that on the. I'm sick and tired of these guys just flaking out on me after they've shot their first person. I need them to completely, stay focused and be able to continue to fight and not wig out, have some sort of moral problem on the battlefield, some sort of crisis of consciousness on the battlefield. Let's just turn that off, and we'll all do better. And you can deal with the crisis of consciousness when you come off the drug. So
reading a science fiction story years ago. It's about a cop who, in the future, while they're on duty dealing with these high-risk, dangerous situations, they've actually have subjected themselves to medical treatment that essentially turns all, like, emotion off, all, like, compassion or attachment to other people is just gone. It's missing from their nature. And this guy comes off a shift where he's dealt with some horrible trauma, only to learn that his wife has been horribly murdered. And he goes on a bender of getting this stuff through the black market. And the story is set many years later, and he has not allowed himself to feel anything ever since because his rational mind looked at that information that he was getting and said, I don't want to feel this, right? And so he has spent years, like, never actually confronting the grief of losing his wife. That falls right in line with the kinds of scenarios we're drawing out here. All kinds of possibilities for,
there's actually
unintended consequences of these kinds of enhancements.
There is a drug that is prescribed to people that have anxiety, social anxiety, where they, if you have a job or something where you have to interact with people and you're one of these painfully shy people that just, can't deal with more than one person at a time, a crowd of three or four people just shuts you down. There are drugs that they administer to people like that. But basically what it does is it does exactly what you described, Bill. It shuts down emotions. It keeps people from feeling anything, including self-consciousness or anything else, And I read a description by a guy that, said, yeah, I have this problem. I'm shy. And, the drug works absolutely. But my wife finally told me, get off that medicine or I'm leaving you. You don't feel anything for anybody or any – you're a robot. And, I didn't understand what she meant until I stopped taking it. And I was just driving to work and, somebody cut me off and I felt angry about being cut off. And it was the first emotion I'd had in a year and a half. He says, wow, he said it was a remarkable experience having emotions come back to you. That's actually not science fiction anymore. It is possible to take a drug that just completely turns off your emotions. And, I don't think that that's necessarily a good one for a lot of people to take,
I can't even imagine. I mean, that just blows my mind, the thought of having no emotions. It seems to me, what would motivate you to do anything, right? I mean, why do you go to work in the morning, right? It's like anxiety about if you don't get your paycheck, right? I mean, ultimately.
Fear motivates us to do a lot of stuff, doesn't it?
I would think. I can't imagine. I can't imagine living without living without emotions. That just sounds like that sounds like non-existence to me. It's completely antithetical to everything that I know of as human existence, but. It's possible. It's achievable now, and you can see where that in the future might actually be thought of as something that would be beneficial in certain lines of work. You mentioned in certain military circumstances, and I think in certain law enforcement circumstances as well. There are just times when you're better off not bringing your feelings into it. good or bad, right? Either being overcome by rage or fear or compassion, if that actually becomes the problem for some individuals in some cases. Wow, so interesting.
Yeah.
I think interesting stuff lies ahead in our use of performance enhancement drugs and what will be seen as performance enhancement. Well, let me take a tangent on this just slightly, and this is another piece that was by Amara Angelica. By the way, for everyone listening, if you're not reading KurzweilAI.net daily, this is just like, you know, there's a few sites that I just recommend so wholeheartedly, and this is one of them, along with Accelerating Future, Next Big Future, and of course, Where There's a William, with Will Listening In. That's one you don't want to miss. Amara has just been outdoing herself lately. She's written some great stuff. And this piece today was called, actually it was earlier this week, What Just Happened? Why Some of Us Seem Totally Spaced Out. And again, some interesting brain research dealing with a piece of the brain called the paracingulate sulcus. Okay. And what it comes down to is if you've got this thing, your memory is reliable, okay? If you don't have it, your memory is not terribly reliable. It's a kind of a fatty lobe that sits right in the front of your brain, and it's just like one variation on one fold in the brain, and it varies widely from person to person. Some people have a great big one, some people have a medium-sized one, some people have none at all. And the less of this thing you have, the less likely you are to have a reliable memory of things that you've witnessed, or things that you've been told, or things that you've heard, or things that you've seen. She starts this out great. She says, "Ever wonder why Uncle Louie seems to imagine stuff that didn't happen and calls you crazy? Well, now here's the explanation." And I'm thinking about that. You know, there are people that you encounter that you just have that experience with, right? It's like either they're in a reality distortion field or I am. One of us is seeing the world differently. We've observed the exact same set of facts, and I'm remembering this, and he or she is remembering that, and those two things are not the same. Well, they used MRI scans to identify people with great big ones of these and people with virtually none, and they ran the same set of tests, and it was basically, you know, memory tests. They'd give them words that go together, you know, peanut butter and jelly, but sometimes it would say peanut butter and jelly, sometimes it would say peanut butter and blank, okay? The people who had the big paracingulate sulcus, they would remember the instances where the two words were seen together and the instances where they were given one word and a blank. The people who don't have that could not distinguish. They could not remember which was which. Their mind fills in the blanks and creates new details where only facts would have been for anyone else. And an interesting quote that really caught my attention on this: "Additionally, this finding might tell us something about schizophrenia, in which hallucinations are often reported, whereby, for example, someone hears a voice when nobody's there," said Dr. John Simons from the University of Cambridge's Department of Experimental Psychology and Clinical Neuroscience Institute. "Difficulty distinguishing real from imagined information might be an explanation for such hallucinations." So not just a key to why some people are, you know, have reliable memories and why some people don't, but a possible explanation for how somebody like our kind of like show sidekick now that I reference once in a while, Emperor Norton, would have ever come to exist, right? How do people have these elaborate delusions and live in this kind of separate reality from the rest of us? You know, we've talked about, well, there's obviously something going on with the brain, and one of the things apparently going on with the brain is a lack of this filtering piece that makes it possible to distinguish real reality from fake reality. Well, this has enormous implications as far as I'm concerned, not just because, you know, more interesting stuff about Emperor Norton, but we originally talked about him in the context of virtual reality, and you say, oh, okay, so whatever it is this thing does, if you had a drug that could suppress that, that would be very helpful in creating a full immersion virtual reality scenario. That would be very helpful in persuading people, giving them a compelling experience, persuading them that they are experiencing something real, or at the very least that they giving them the memory that they had experienced something real. Or if you want to look at this, you want to flip this one over and look at it from the standpoint of performance enhancement, this would be a real gap that possibly some kind of drug could overcome.
Right.
This little fold is doing something. Whatever it's doing, people who are missing that would, I think, benefit tremendously by having that capability provided via some other means, whether it's via a neural implant or, you know, you would think if there's a, you know, if there's a drug to make you smarter or a drug to keep you awake, that ultimately there might be a drug to help you distinguish real memories from fake memories.
There is a new TV show on this fall, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of it. It's about a detective, it was a woman who has total recall. She remembers everything that's happened to her since she was, you know, a baby. And, you know, can tell you every minute of every day, you know, what was going on at that time, which would be, you know, what a gift for a person who's a detective, right? You know, the ability to remember every single detail about the way someone reacted to you in a conversation. You know, you walk through a room and you can tell, you can then recall years later everything that was on a particular shelf. You know, things like that. It's an interesting premise for a detective show, but what if there are things that we could do to tweak our, you know, just everyone, all of our minds to allow us to remember stuff? And then on the other hand, there was a story out this week, Phil, that was touting the usefulness of being able to forget stuff. You know, there's some things that you just need to let go of.
Tell us about that. What do we need to forget?
Well, I mean...
I know, even before you say
okay.
it. The second two Matrix movies, right?
What's that?
The second two Matrix movies, for example. If we could just, like,
yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Excise those from our memories.
Yeah, that's right. And the Star Wars prequels.
But anyway, there you go.
things like that. Well, I mean, you know, we've all had terrible experiences in our lives, and some of us are scarred to the extent from these from really, really bad experiences that, you know, it would become dysfunctional. And so the ability to forget some things might be, you know, or at least to let them go, you know, it might be helpful to some people. I think there's a movie a few years back with, what's the funny guy, Jim Carrey, where he went through a painful breakup, and he chose to. I just want to forget the entire relationship.
Oh, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. That's right. People were
removing
memories of entire relationships from their brains via brain surgery. Yeah.
So, maybe being able to forget some things is a blessing, but what a gift also to be able to remember the things you need to remember. So, you tell me, Phil. I mean. Which is better? I mean, you think that living as we do somewhere in the middle, being able to forget stuff, but also being able to remember most and particularly the things that are usually important, maybe that's the best way to live, the way we're already wired. I don't know.
The thing is, I think to be at either extreme is to see the value of this middle position. But having said that, if you were going to give me a choice, if you're going to say, okay, I've got two sets of capabilities, and you can only have one of them. You can edit your memory to make you forget things, or you can have the, what is it called, like eidetic memory? And I can't think of the name of that show either, but that this lady has on this TV show, and you can remember everything. And what's, you know, it's not just every detail of your life, but every book she picks up, if she scans it, right, it's all there from then on.
Yeah.
Right? She knows. She knows all of it. Everything she's ever heard, it's all completely, perfectly retained. Given that choice, I'll take the second option. I'll take the perfect memory of everything.
You know, if I were that person with that gift, I think I would be very careful what I put into my brain. I would be very,
yeah.
you know, I would I would read all the reviews of a movie before I went to see it. I would, you know, I'd want to know, well, what's this book about? I wouldn't necessarily, you know, that's, you know, if you go and see a terrible movie that's just awful and just, you know, gouge your eyes out terrible, you know, at least usually it's forgettable. You know, I mean, the worst movies we tend to forget. If you have that particular gift, it would be a bit of a curse if you're constantly reliving, you know, terrible artwork.
Well, it was a joke, but I mean, I really can't remember much of the detail of those second two Matrix movies. I really couldn't tell you much of what happens in those movies. It's kind of a blur, right? You kind of let it go. But surely even someone who has that ability gets to pick to some extent what they choose to think about, right?
So yeah, what she dwells on.
If I wanted to dredge it up, I could remember it in great detail, but I choose to focus my attention on something else, right? Even though I could still settle an argument over that particular movie if I needed to, because I would remember it perfectly. So what would you pick of those two?
I guess I'd have to go with the same thing, Phil. You know, I'm fortunate in my life that I've not had, you know, the sort of, you know, psychologically scarring things that I know that other, you know, that other people that, you know, I'm familiar with have experienced. You know, there's, you know, no painful divorces, you know, things like that. Even more painful things, people who've lost a child. I mean, there are awful things that happen to people that, you know, just, you know, that you would want to be able to eventually move past and to dwell on other things. And I can kind of understand the, you know, why some person might seek the eternal sunshine of a spotless mind approach. You know, if somebody's been through something awful enough, so you know,
I'm telling you that if I had to pick between two of them, if you gave me both of them, I'd make good use of both of them. Actually, I think there are a few things I would pare back in my memory if not take out altogether. Well, here we are with just a couple of minutes left, and this is the second week in a row I've promised that we were going to talk about the post-work world, and we're not going to talk about it next week either, because next week we're going to be welcoming Sonia Arison to talk about her book 100+. So that's going to be great. We're going to be on at a special time, 30 minutes later than usual next week. So everyone, plan on joining us at 7:30 Pacific, 10:30 Eastern time. And Stephen, what's our music?
The music tonight is "My Time" by Legalize.
My Time by Legalize. Well, thank you so much for putting that together, Stephen. And it's great chatting with you as always. Thanks to all of you for listening live. Nice chat going on in the chat room. I assume Sally's out watching the World Series, so probably pulling for the National League. So go Cardinals, I guess I have to say. Thanks for being with us. Hope you'll be with us next week when, once again, our guest will be Sonia Arison. We'll be talking about 100+. And until next time, live to see it.